In order that all sentient beings may attain Buddhahood, from my heart I take refuge in the three jewels. In order that all sentient beings may attain Buddhahood, from my heart I take refuge in the three jewels. In order that all sentient beings may attain Buddhahood, from my heart I take refuge in the three jewels. Whatever the virtues of the many fields of knowledge, all are steps on the path of omniscience. May these arise in the clear mirror of intellect. O Manjushri, please accomplish this. Good evening, welcome. Tonight we continue our exploration of the view in the Buddhist tradition. And we start with the Abhidharma view, the so-called Abhidharma view, which is meant to erode the sense that we all have as we walk around during our daily lives, thinking that there's a me that inhabits a body that is equivalent to its outline, that moves and exists in space and observes the phenomena that exist in that space and interacts with those phenomena. And so tonight we'll try to blow that view apart by looking at the Abhidharma point of view. And Chris and I, we talked about starting with the second reading, and Chris wanted to dive into an atom. Or was it a molecule that you wanted to dive into?
Well, I suppose we'll talk about both, and perhaps there being some ambiguity between the two. We wanted to talk about atoms in particular for a few reasons. One is that so many people associate the Abhidharma, you know, the catchphrase is Abhidharma, Buddhist psychology. And you know, these were people who were very concerned with what's real in the world, which included, yes, psychology, but also the nature of form, the nature of the material that we interact with. And since so many of us are closet materialists still, after all these years of sitting, I thought an exploration of form and matter through the eyes of the Abhidharma would be interesting for us to look at. So they, like in the West, you know, back to ancient Greece, there was a notion of atomism. So this notion existed in India as well. Although it appears to have originated outside of the Buddhist tradition and wasn't one we see in the early sutras. But I did want to share, before we jump in to the text, if you'll indulge me, I wanted to share my screen. Let's see. Can you all see this? Yeah. Okay, so I had these are sort of cell phone photos, so they're not the best, but I was in New York City recently, and I went to MoMA and saw the Hilma af Klint show that closed a couple weeks ago. And she made these really wonderful paintings of atoms. These are little models of atoms that she was painting. This one, I guess, was painted on January 17th of 1917. So the notion of subatomic particles had been discovered fairly recently. And Hilma af Klint, if you're not familiar with her work, was sort of influenced by the theosophist movement. And either them or one of the other schools associated with it believed that you could actually perceive atoms by, you know, increasing your spiritual sensitivity. So I wanted to show these, not that they have anything to do with ancient India at all, but to show these as a alternative way to thinking about atoms versus the way we normally think about them. You know, with this bundle of protons and nucleus and spinning electrons. These is just as like a, you know, a very different idea of what atoms could look like as a way of, I don't know, opening us up a little bit to alternative notions, which we'll explore. So I just thought these were so fun and interesting and just different than what we're used to. So I'll leave that at that. And thank you for indulging me.
I saw her show years ago
At the Guggenheim?
at the Guggenheim. Yeah,
That was
it was
cool, wasn't it?
amazing. That was very cool.
Incredible.
She was out there.
Yeah, that was like her breakout moment.
Right. They hadn't been shown like since she made them, or it was some weird situation.
They'd been like little bits and they'd show up here and there, but it was really the first time that she'd been given really serious attention and I think sort of caught on.
So as you're describing the scene, the reality of atoms and molecules that the Abidharmas discovered, being slightly facetious, can you think also about what's the relationship between an atom and a dharma? And maybe you can return back to that at some point. But
I think
thanks,
that's
Chris.
I think that the atoms that we're going to be looking at here are the smallest unit of matter, right? So this is a system in which the world is made of both form and mind. Modern, maybe Peter can help us out with this, but the general consensus in modern physics is that mind is sort of shut out of that, and that matter is the main thing. But that was not their system. They didn't have the sort of, at least as severe of a Cartesian split as we tend to in the West. And their system involved matter and minds existing on something of a similar plane. They're both dharmas. But in particular, this chapter discusses form, matter, rupa. Yeah, let's get into it. I'm going to start at the bottom of page 119, which is the source page 295, source book 119, 295. The Vaibhashika concedes that an atom as the smallest unit of matter is known through mental analysis. This is called the conceptual atom. It is from this perspective that one could speak of Paramanu as corresponding to the notion of atom. Nevertheless, this does not mean that atoms exist only as a concept. The conceptual is always based on the ultimately real, and the ultimately real atom is the intrinsic character of matter. While a single Paramanu cannot be directly observed, a physical assemblage of them is known through direct perception. So then we have a traditional definition from one of the sources. One of the reasons we wanted to include this text was that it actually draws on actual Abhidharma sources, as opposed to Western scholastic sources. So this is a translation. An atom, Paramanu, is the smallest rupa. It cannot be cut, broken, penetrated. It cannot be taken up, abandoned, ridden on, stepped on, struck, or dragged. It is neither long nor short, square nor round, regular nor irregular, convex nor concave. It has no smaller parts. It cannot be decomposed, cannot be seen, heard, smelled, touched. It is thus that the Paramanu is said to be the finest of all rupas. Seven of these Paramanus constitute an Anu, the finest among all rupas perceivable by the eye and visual consciousness. However, this Anu can only be seen by three types of eyes: the Divya Chakshus, which is the divine eye in Indian thought, the eye of the universal monarch, and the eye of a bodhisattva in his last birth. And then we have sort of a cascade of seven Anus constitute a Tamra Raja, seven of those constitute an Apraja, and so on and so forth. In this way, the whole visual universe is composed.
So the conglomeration of seven of the smallest makes this makes next smallest, and a conglomeration of seven of the next smallest makes the next, and so forth. I
And the
think for
conglomeration of seven is the smallest thing that can be perceived, but not by us,
not
but
by
by very
ordinary
special
mere
people.
mortals, right?
Yeah. But it's very interesting that, like the last life of a bodhisattva, or a Chakravartin, they can't perceive the smallest one. They can only perceive a conglomeration, the smallest conglomeration. And
And then
we'll get into
seven.
why seven is an important number later. Yeah. Any questions so far? Cool.
In a text by Mipham called The Gateway to Knowledge, the translators give the translations of these terms, which I couldn't find here. And they had very funny names, like a louse particle, and I think the largest was a mouse particle, was the largest conglomeration that we can actually see.
I was drawn to the second to last line in the first paragraph there, where it says it cannot be decomposed. So, what happened to impermanence?
Yeah, that's a really
Right.
big one. I was noticing that too. What do you make of that, Chris?
Well, it could be as simple as it can't be decomposed into smaller parts. I think that's what it means, that these are partless particles. And how sort of
Yeah, I agree.
comprehensive, like if that's a notion that can be made sense of, is something that's going to be picked up.
So really, it's like an atom has seven substances in it as opposed to parts. It's not it, the way that the
Well,
parts implies is that like the different ones that are enumerated exist in different physical locations of the combined sevenfold particle, but it's really more like they have a quality of materiality, they have a quality of water, and so forth.
but those qualities are defined in terms of atoms. So they, again,
But
from
what is an
this
atom?
quote, an atom, a paramanu, is the smallest rupa that cannot be cut, broken, or penetrated. And then seven of those constitute an anu. And that's the conglomeration that has the, form, water, and some of the sense qualities that can be perceived.
But they never talk about the spaces between the seven and whether the seven can join. They only talk about then whether that sevenfold compilation can join with other sevenfold compilations. So when they say it's made of rupa, which is the smallest, it's the smallest manifestation of rupa of matter. It seems like matter is more of a quality than an actual entity, discrete entity. And like there was, sorry, never mind. It was in a further part of our reading that we didn't have in the source book, which I'll show later. But like if we look at the substance, they use this analogy of gold, that like gold when it's solid, becomes liquid, and it still has a quality of being gold. And so there's a difference between its manifestation in a certain form and its inherent essence. So like the sevenfold particle has earth in it. But but it varies depending on how much earth there is compared to the other elements. Anyway, but
So I think I
keep
sorry,
going.
I don't want to contradict you, but I think there is there's the if we go to page 262, source page 262, source book page 122, 834, the minimum octet as a molecule that arises. In the physical order, a minimum of eight substances consisting of the subtlest aggregate, Samgata Paramanu, are necessarily conoscent in the sphere of sensuality. The four great elements plus form, smell, taste, and touch. The Samgata Paramanu may be compared to the notion of a molecule, in contrast with the Dravya Paramanu, a single atom as a real entity. So you have atoms have this quality of existing in sets of seven, but then they come together in sets of eight, and those eight are the four great elements plus the four sense bases. This leads to some complications. And there's sort of a funny figure that he gives, and he doesn't totally explain the math. This is gonna be on page source book page 125, source page 265. Problems connected with the notion of atoms. And then in the second sentence of that, or sorry, yeah, I'll just start there. The second sentence of that, it would seem that the first four Mahabhatus, so those are the four great elements, were conceived of as being material qualities. Earth element is solidity, etc. They are real entities qua material qualities. But when the atomic theory was introduced into the Abhidharma system, the notion that matter is constituted of atoms and that the great elements, Mahabhatus, exist as atoms came to be developed. This led to a contradiction that seems to be left, to seems to have been quietly left unsettled. On the one hand, the atomic theory requires that atoms are grouped in septuplets, or groups of seven, from which matter is derived. The smallest molecule, or Anu, or Samgata Paramanu, consisting of just seven paramanus, is the smallest unit of matter that is perceivable, and even by then, not by an ordinary human being. On the other hand, a new doctrine was then articulated that a molecule can arise in the empirical, a molecule that can arise in the empirical world consists of a minimum of eight substances. Taking both doctrines into consideration, one commentarial opinion, in fact, arrives at 1,379 as the number of atoms that constitute a molecule of the visible. This contradiction, and I take that contradiction to be that that's simply too large of a number of atoms for the smallest unit of a visible thing. This contradiction, however, would not have necessarily arisen if the Mahabhatus, the great elements, were conceived of as Dravya in the sense of real material qualities, real forces, rather than atoms. So what's being said here is that what began as the four great elements being described in terms of qualities of things, that sort of gets shoehorned into this atomistic model in which, in order for those qualities to exist, they have to exist as atoms. And that makes the whole system very clunky. Apart from this, this very notion of an atom being this ultimately indivisible, impenetrable unit of matter devoid of extension gives rise to conceptual difficulties. And then we're going to get into some of these conceptual difficulties. He begins with a definition of Rupana, and basically defining rupa as as that which has obstruction. So matter, occupies space, and then other things can't occupy the space that that matter is occupying. So, are there intervening spaces between atoms, or do they touch one another? I'm on the top of page 127, source page 267. If two atoms touch one another, they do so either at a point of contact or in their totality. In either case, there is a problem. The former implies that an atom has parts or extension. So if they touch one another, there has to be a point of contact. There has to be this side touches that side, rather than the other way around. Does that make sense? The left side of something touches the right side of another, and that's how things fit together. But the atoms are meant to be without parts. They can't have a right and a left side. They're sort of individual points without dimensionality. The latter, being that the totality of the atom touches itself, would result in two or more atoms coalescing into a single unit. So if they don't touch on one or the other side, they have to touch in their totality. And if they touch in their totality, they seem to occupy the same space, which is a contradiction since their very definition is that they occupy space that isn't occupied by anything else. The latter would result in two or more atoms coalescing into a single unit. In fact, the whole physical universe in this case ought to be the size of a single atom. On the other hand, if they do not touch at all, an agglomeration of atoms would fall to pieces when struck. Which I suppose means they don't stick together. They need to touch in order to stick together, and form agglomerations. Besides, how does one explain the sound being produced when two rupus strike against each other? Let's leave that one. The Vaibhashika position is that atoms do not touch. It is solely by the force of the wind element that atoms are held together. The production of sound, in fact, okay, I guess they do get into it. The production of sound, in fact, is precisely possible because atoms do not touch, for otherwise they would merge with the hand, etc., that strikes, and there being no space in between, how can sound be produced? And so this is a sort of a different strategies for answering the question about whether atoms can touch or whether there's space between them. So then we have someone named Vasu Mitra, who explains that atoms cannot touch because they're momentary. The possibility of touch would imply an atom can endure for more than one moment. What did you make of that, Derek, that momentariness implies non-contact?
Oh, sorry, where does he say that?
This is page source book page 127. Vasu Mitra explains that atoms cannot touch one another because they're momentary. The possibility of touch would imply that an atom can endure for more than one moment.
That's an odd statement.
These guys don't really have a theory of fields or forces, do they?
No,
It
that's what
seems
they're
that
missing.
the forces are, like I said earlier, shoehorned into the atomism. So,
Well, like gravity, how would they account for gravity?
no.
They don't. They, in the list that we of dharmas that we looked at last week or two. They have things like life force and time and duration, but they don't have gravity. They
Because
didn't.
particles could interact via gravity.
Yeah.
They don't have to touch necessarily.
Right. They didn't have a notion of
But they
like a
didn't seem to
field.
have a and they can decay. That's another of the the physics forces is things decay. But that's a force. It's not doesn't it's sort of built into the system. but they don't seem to talk about forces at all. For them, it's all like cue balls and billiard balls that either bounce against each other or don't.
Well, they try to explain forces in the sense of like what makes a dharma decay. And they go through like this, the options are either it's programmed to decay, or there's another unit of reality or an entity that.
Maybe impermanence is the force
Right.
that's built into the system.
Right. It's a quality of each dharma.
And that's certainly sort of the sad tantric view that we talked about last time, right? That dharmas exist momentarily and decay sort of immediately.
So just to go through the theory of the particles, the smallest unit of matter, I think there's a confusion in that the smallest unit of matter has eight substances. And the substances are not atoms, but the conglomeration of the eight substances is an atom. And then conglomerations of atoms are molecules, as opposed to each of the eight being an atom, for all that that's worth. But yes, they don't seem to have like a sense. Well, for them, like
So that's not what it says in the source, right?
yeah. So let's read it. Where?
Yeah, the source text, again, this is page 120, under the heading 831, descriptive definition of an atom. An atom is the smallest rupa, cannot be cut, broken, penetrated, and so on. Seven of these constitute an anu, finest among all rupas, perceivable by the eye.
Right, so seven atoms constitutes an anu.
Yeah.
He hasn't defined what an atom is yet. He hasn't gone into the detail of what an atom is yet.
Yeah, I mean, we get a lot of things about what it isn't. It can't be cut,
Right.
broken, penetrated, taken up, abandoned, ridden on, stepped on, struck, or dragged. Neither long nor
Right.
short, square nor round.
And then 8.3.4, the minimum octet as a molecule.
Eight substances constituting the smallest aggregate.
But they're confused. This is an atom. The eight substances comprise an atom, and then seven of those eight substanced particles makes an anu, paramanu, and so forth. So each atom has eight substances.
And do they define a substance anywhere?
Of eight substances
Well,
constituting
I'm
the
wondering
cells.
if so be a way that they're getting it is the through the connection with perception or empirical accessibility of something. So this is like the finest thing that can be perceived by some realized being is this atom, and the atom happens being perceptible. It's sort of sui generis, being perceptible. It happens to have a certain number of qualities. And that's just the way it is when something is perceived by a realized being at the finest level. Sort of like if you take, an electron is just going to have a certain mass, and it's going to have a certain charge, and it's going to have a certain spin. And so you could say that those are constituents, but they're not things that you could take apart or separate from the electron. Those qualities or properties make up what is the smallest particle that we have, an electron. And so maybe it's somehow, that's somehow like what they're getting at here, is that there, if something is to be perceived by a sentient being, then simply from the fact of empiricism, we find that it has these qualities, and therefore we can enumerate the separate qualities if you're that mm-hmm. realized. You could see that they're all there, but they can't, they're never separate from that perception, that finding.
I think that's exactly right.
Thank and they deduce those qualities because they're manifest in the world. Mm-hmm. And so like things like gravity are created by the cohesive quality of water. If that makes any sense. That was a conversation stopper. Sorry. Tell us in
maybe more electromagnetism than gravity, but yeah, I get you. I understand.
in physics, an atom has parts: electrons, protons, neutrons. Is that right, Peter?
Well, there's sort of. I think that there are two ways to look at it if you're talking about physics. There's, ultimately these days in physics, there's quantum theory, right? Before that, there was a theory of particles, which sort of Newton and then others, you know, put together. And Newton, by the way, was very, very unhappy with his theory of gravitation just because particles didn't touch in order to act on him. And he said, this is not a good theory. This is an ugly theory. So that was for that. But as far as the quantum theory seems to really, really hold up, but the quantum theory isn't about particles. The quantum theory is a framework of how you would put together a theory. So it's basically, there are four parts to quantum theory, and you put, and whatever theory you make, whether it's of water or of atoms, it's got to fit in this framework that's dictated by quantum theory, which just again and again holds up. So like the quantum physicist is like the very realized being who could look at things very finely and finds that whatever it is, it's always appearing in a certain mode that follows a small number of rules. So looking at getting too focused on the way we think of atoms as like a little planetary system, that's really not how physics today thinks about things. It's more thinking about what are the consequences of the basic structure that any physical theory is going to have. And that's what's dictated by, you know, what Bohr and Heisenberg gave us.
That's interesting. It's in my very simplistic and totally naive way of understanding what you just said and assimilating that into even more naive and ignorant understanding of science, let's say. It's like atomism is more like Abhidharma, and what you just described is more like Yogacara.
It gets very, very close to Yogacara. Like if you just do classical physics, it's like Abhidharma, and you can say that things don't exist, and they go through that exercise. Because it's all partless particles for the classical physicist, and unfortunately never makes the leap as to what the sort of spiritual consequence of that is, but you know, that's physics.
And so classical physics then is particles.
Yeah.
You even said partless particles, but so that's where you have like the little planetary system that you described, right?
Yeah, and then they do throw in forces because you have to, otherwise you got to make something up.
some sort of
as to
glue
how
or
they
whatever.
interact without touching each other. So the Abhidharmists were right on that. That's a real problem, is if they don't touch, you know.
And then those little planetary systems that we might call atoms, they couldn't congeal into molecules. Is that right? They come
Well, I
together.
mean, by the time you get to atoms, then you do have to make a sort of, you very quickly have to make a switch to quantum theory, and then any kind of picture like that just completely falls
So
apart.
what happened to molecules? What
Same thing
happened
for a
to
molecule. Same thing for a molecule, yeah.
But molecules are classical physics then.
No, those are quantum physics too.
Molecules.
Yes.
So like the water molecule, what is how does that relate to atoms?
That's quantum atoms interacting quantum mechanically and sticking together quantum mechanically.
H2O, like one. So are the electrons in all atoms equal?
Yes, they're equal, but they live in different sort. They're differently. They live in different rooms of
Sorry,
the
you
water
broke up a
molecule.
little bit. Your sound is
Oh, I'm
great.
sorry. I think I have my internet connection is not so good.
They live in different rooms.
Well, I mean, there's a in which you can't actually completely distinguish between them, but you can say they're, for example, electrons that are taking different roles in the atom. There's a thing about indistinguishability, which is very, very fundamental, which again gets very much probably like a sort of a Yogacharan view of things are all interpenetrating. And but I'll tell you, if I could, I just would tell you one thing that's really fundamental about this view that's more modern, and that's is in the four basic tenets or postulates of quantum mechanics. What it's basically, the message is that there is a huge mix-up between ontology and epistemology. That's what's built in, is that you are forced to give up a distinction between what you can know and what is. You cannot separate those. That's just built right into the way the theory is constructed.
Say
And
that
because,
again, between what is and what you can know.
so there's a wonderful quote by a physicist named Edwin Jaynes, I think his name was. And he said, real problem with quantum theory, which AKA is the best empirical observation we have for the physicist, you know, if you really looked like a super Abhidharmist, what would you come up with? He said the real problem with the quantum theory is that you cannot distinguish whether or not it's an ontological theory about things or an epistemological theory about how we know about things. And he said, he gave this great little quote. He said, it's like Bohr and Heisenberg got together and scrambled the whole egg. The yolk is epistemology and the white is the ontology. And he scrambled all up, and nobody has ever figured out how to unscramble that omelet. And until we do, we will just simply never really be able to know what we're talking about, because unless we can separate epistemology. So that's the quantum problem that's imposed by looking at how things bounce around, how electrons and atoms move. You end up with this conclusion, is that knowing and what is known are completely independent all the way down. So there you are, something
That's
like
cool.
that, you know.
Thank you,
It's,
Peter
I
and
mean,
Chris.
what's so fascinating with that story you just told us about the progression from Newtonian physics to quantum theory and sort of the unraveling of this ontological question. And it feels like what motivated the whole physical enterprise to begin with was so much about like understanding what is real, what is the world. And as you pursue that question, the very foundations of it are disrupted by what's observable. And it feels like a lot of the Abhidharma material is running into the same sort of problem, that when you look at things very closely, they can't possibly exist the way that we want them to, that our worldview sort of depends on them existing.
Yeah, so it's like what we thought was falls apart, and what the quantum experience brings in is that you can't even know how you're knowing. You can't even know if you're looking at it or at the real thing. You just seem, and you can't in principle not know. That's kind of what it's saying. It's all relational.
And yet you carry on, and you can do quantum mechanics, and you can press the button on your remote and the TV turns on. There's a sort of a usable output from this work, even though it's sort of groundless.
And it's predictable.
Well, it's even better than that, because what got the Nobel Prize 2 years ago was the founding of experimental metaphysics, where they were actually experimentally be able to show that certain things you cannot know. And they did a measurement that showed that. I mean, it's a little complicated, the reasoning, but it ends up being just like, oh, if the number is bigger than two, then it means that things are completely entangled, and there is no separating things. And so it's kind of cool that you can know that you can't know something like that.
I'm so glad that their problems mean nothing to me, and that I have one less problem than they do. But anyway, could we like on a simple basis, like Chris, Peter, how do you describe what we experience? Like, what is it a table when we think we see a table? What do we see?
Well, anybody can answer that better than me, or
Chris, what do we see when we see a table?
I mean, are you asking me, or are you asking sort of like a from an Abhidharma point of view?
Both Abhidharma and physics.
I think from an Abhidharma point of view, the only thing that is being experienced are, conglomerations of dharmas, and tableness is a conceptual projection that gets superimposed onto those and mistaken for something that's real.
But we see conglomerations of dharmas, you said. And so, what's the relationship between dharmas and atoms?
I think atoms, in this case, atoms are a particular type of dharma, specifically a physical dharma, a rupa dharma, rather than mental dharmas, which also exist in
And
Nirvana.
so an atom is a conglomeration of eight dharmas.
You know what I'm realizing as we pour through this text is that there's conflicting definitions. Oops, sorry about that. In some cases, the atoms are grouped in seven, and these are spatially arranged, and then those create groups of eight. And then in other cases, eight is sort of the primary number that then gets grouped in seven. So.
In the seven scheme, do you ever find a place where they enumerate what the seven different things are?
I think they're defined. The importance of the number seven is how they exist spatially, and it's getting us back to this idea of gaps between atoms, and so on. And the problem is that these atoms are meant to have no dimension at all, but then are supposed to create a three-dimensional world, right? The world that we
Yeah, that's not a problem, though.
So,
I mean,
so
and
how
look
do
at physics.
so so how do you build a table out of things without dimension? You know, how are they going to stack on top of each other, right? So this sevenfold cluster is proposed. The individual pieces don't have dimension, but they're arranged in sort of a matrix. So there's one in the middle, then two on the top, one on either side, and then one in the front and one in the back.
You
And
know,
that's how you get.
it's like the Treasury Secretary, whatever it was, said at one point of like, a few billion here, a few billion there, and eventually you're talking about some real money.
So the idea is you have this mate, if you don't have you just have like these little points that in aggregate create a three-dimensional matrix, but they don't have dimensions themselves. That's how they tried to solve this problem. Whether or not that's convincing is another question.
Well, but again, going back to, when Derek asked, what do we see? And, like when we see a table, what do we see? And you said we'd see a conglomeration of dharmas. I'm not exactly sure what a conglomeration of dharmas looks like.
Looks like a table.
Or many other things, right? So I guess I guess the between the table and the dharmas, is there anything in between those, or it goes straight from this matrix pile of dharmas that somehow miraculously stack like a house of cards into the table?
From the point of view of Abhidharma, there's nothing real between table and Dharma. There's not like sort of a supervenience thing where you've got they exist in conglomerations of particles, but those conglomerations aren't ultimately real. Only the individual dharmas are ultimately real.
And then the other question I guess I have is that in one sense, I think we've been taught somewhere that what we see when we experience, we don't really see, a table. Obviously, we impose the idea on it, but we see like shape and light.
We see color.
Well, I didn't even want to say color because I figured you would tell me that the color happens in my brain and it's only light at the level of the table. But anyway.
Within the Abhidharma,
With Abhidharma, we see color, right?
color is a fundamental thing. Well, so
Okay,
there's some
so
disagreement about that.
how does
For the
that help?
Sarvastivadins, shape and color are both dharmas. And for the
They've
Sautantrikas,
been
they say
smoking.
shape is a conceptual
Yeah,
superimposition
it's
and
just
only
color,
color
right?
exists.
Yeah, so when we look at the chart of the dharmas, we see the four great elements, and then we see color and sound and so forth. And so those are dharmas that make up atoms.
Okay, because I guess that's where, in terms of this question of what do we actually see, if we're seeing shape and color, is that shape a
Just
collection
color,
of us?
just color, just color.
Or just color only because color makes the shape? Is that what we're saying? So we only
Yeah.
see one thing? Okay, so we see only color.
Of conglomerates of
And that's
dharmas.
those colors are basically conglomerates of dharmas.
That's right.
If you see a,
It's
let's
the
say,
color aspect of the dharmas that are conglomerated.
so let's use the imaginary of what we would call a blue table that has a round top, right? So we would see this round blue shape, or I'm sorry, we would see round blueness, right? And so what we're seeing there is the collection of dharmas that makes up that round blueness.
Yeah.
Then it has some legs, let's say that.
But we're yeah, so we're okay on that level, like the large scale. And then we have the small scale sort of, imaginatively portrayed as particles that have different dharmas that make them up, whether it's seven or eight. And then we have this quandary of how do they conglomerate? And they're sort of magically conglomerate without touching, without impacting, without having any spatial relationships to each other. because space is not real, so they don't need to conform to spatial locations, right? Is that what you said, Chris?
Well, space is unconditioned, and in certain models there is space. The reason that atoms don't touch is because there's space between them, which is like, okay, so if is the
How
space
many space
obstructing them?
particles? How many
If is
particles of space?
the space is the space obstructing them, in which case isn't space matter? And it's so there was a clever solution that, oh, the space is just smaller than the atom, so they can't get into it. It's just like,
And matter is what is molested.
molested.
Yeah, did you pick up on some of the terminology? Did anyone pick up on that? Matter is what's molested. Nobody saw that? Oh, that was in a different part. I read the wrong sections by mistake of the other text.
I remember seeing that in another
In other
class.
things, it's like matter,
Yeah.
it's that which can be formed, shaped, impinged upon, they use this weird term, molested. But
Maybe
anyway,
molested is more appropriate.
so we've explored the form, the aspects of form, which is one of the two broad types of realities. Do you want to talk about how mind is conglomerated out of mind particles?
No, I don't. I'm just like totally beyond anything I can make sense of. But I'd love to hear you talk about it, Derek.
It's so interesting that they did have like a smallest moment of time, that time had a discrete quality to it. And I'm probably saying
I
that
think
because I read
it's the same it's the
correctly.
same reason that you have the smallest moment of matter is if you're trying to get something that's ultimately real, it has to bottom out somewhere. And they want time to be real in the same way they want matter to be real. So there has to be a smallest thing so you can say, aha, there it is. There's the thing.
You reminded me that one of the controversies was that arhats, when they get enlightened, they say, aha. I swear, that's one of the arguments they have. Do you want to go
These are
through
the sort of
touching?
things that people did to entertain themselves before we had television. Have these sorts of arguments.
Guess they get tired of creating animals in the stars in the sky. They finished that and they've had to do other things.
One thing that's not clear to me is whether or not we should interpret the Abhidharma as them making really strong ontological commitments that might vary depending on the school or something, or whether they're sort of bootstrapping because they take the certain empirical sort of facts as given, and they don't try to push the ontology beyond that. They say, so we observe that there's minus bit of time, so that's more of an observational fact, but I don't have to elevate it to some higher ontological status, and same for the particles.
I think that is certainly how they began, how the Abhidharma project began was more of an epistemological project. But I think at a certain point there were ontological bills they had to pay.
Well, I'm not sure about that. I mean, because it's like the difference between a theory being phenomenological or a theory being fundamental. And maybe they're not making a fundamental theory. It's perfectly good to have a phenomenological theory that holds together, is self-consistent, and helps us to understand our experience and the nature of the three marks of existence or whatever.
There's a, I think Jay Garfield said that to deny doing fundamental ontology is still doing fundamental ontology. So you can, I think it's a question that they did seek to avoid, but at a certain point, there, I don't know. My point of view is, and I think the point of view of Madhyamaka is that it's a question that they have to answer.
That line of Jay Garfield sounds a little bit like the Satchel Paige. Is it Satchel Paige? Not to decide is to decide. Not to deny doing ontology is still doing it, more or less. That's.
Yes, but it's so it could be you could take that as a position, but they are distinct.
Yes, I
So
think that's
you
right.
could.
And thank you for making that point. Yeah, they are distinct. They are distinct, but I don't know. I think there's still a certain amount of inevitability to the ontological questions that they don't go away.
I suspect probably what happened was they were yelled at by other teachers of other schools and traditions and Hindus and various others say, so what is real? What's your view? I want to know what reality is. You know, come on, Buddhists, come up with something.
That
And they're
does
going,
seem to
oh
be
my, then my God, we got to go back and figure out something to answer this guy. He's driving me nuts.
does seem to be the case that the Abhidharma project seems to have begun as Buddhists really trying to articulate their own views and gradually became a very important set of definitions in order for Buddhists to engage in the deeply polemic environment of classical India. In which they were not only debating other Buddhist schools, but also, the Jains and the various Brahmanical schools. Speaking of other Buddhist schools, Derek, do you want to take us through the Theravadins?
Yes, and I hope I don't upset you, but I want to go into a section that we didn't assign, and I'll show it on the screen. Just need to find it in the PDF here. So the we have all these different schemes of dharmas that the assigned reading goes through, lists of dharmas, which isn't that interesting. And then the text goes through the idea of whether things, dharmas exist in the three times or not, which we saw last week. But okay, I believe this is the section I wanted to show. Oh, here we go. Let's drill into this, the definition of a dharma as own nature. The Theravadins, so they didn't go for the tri-temporality that phenomena exist through the three times, that the dharmas. But they were influenced by Sarvastivada in one way. It's the use by them of the term swabhava. So you guys can see this on screen, yes? Thank you. Own being or own nature as another expression for dharma. Swabhava in the sense of dharma doesn't occur in any of the books of the Abhidharma. It's only later in the exegesis of the Abhidharma text, commentaries, and so forth that we find the term used. It occurs in the Patisamvittamagga, which is one of the main commentaries. I think on the first Abhidharma text, the five aggregates are described as empty of their own nature, their own being. So in terms of looking at the idea of Dharma as having an essence or a swabhava. And I don't think you have this in the source book, right? The source book only had a few pages. Now let's skip this. Well, so this occurrence in a text called the Netipakarana, a work on Buddhist hermeneutics early in the tradition. So it's neat, interesting that even in the Abhidharma tradition, they had works on hermeneutics. And we saw last week I circulated some table of contents from a text called the Katuvatu, which was a compilation of issues of disagreement or discussion. And the Netipakarana presents different views and talks about them. Here in a discussion of dependent arising, we find a distinction made between hetu, cause, and pachaya as conditions. So these are the two groups of forces that are used to describe dependent arising, that there's causes and conditions. And causes are, let's see, hetu, earth, and the seed is the cause in the example of a plant, and earth and water are its conditions. So you see the difference between cause and condition. Cause, the seed, is like the directly in a direct role of productivity, whereas conditions are supporting activities in productivity or production. The first is specific, the second generic. Hetu has a characteristic not shared by others. So it has a characteristic that is unique to itself. Whereas conditions have a characteristic that's shared with other phenomena. So in this case, you say the tree arose from a specific seed, and that's specific to that tree. And that's like the specifically characterized dharmas, whereas the conditions of earth and water are common to many phenomena, many other trees. Hetu is an internal quality, and conditions are, so causes internal, conditions are external. Cause is the thing that is proper to a given dharma, proper like essential, hence it is called swabhava. Essence, own nature. Since conditions, pachayas, are the things to help it externally, they're called other nature. The first explicit reference in a Theravada work to the idea that a given thing has its own nature. Whether this led to the use of swabhava in the sense of dhamma is difficult to ascertain. It's very likely, however, that here the Pali commentators were influenced by the Sarvastivada, for swabhava was used in Sarvastivada as another term for dharma long before the Pali commentaries were compiled. So in the Sarvastivada, swabhava and dharma are sort of synonymous. The question arises here is, in which sense do the Theravadins use swabhava as another expression for dharma? This will become clear if we examine the commentarial definition of dharma, which is as follows. So this is the essential part, the definition of a dharma, dhamma in the Theravadins. Dhammas are so called because they bear their own nature. This definition once implies that dharma and swabhava are two different things. They are, there's a phenomena and then its own nature. And the phenomena bear their own nature. So you immediately get into this conundrum that's largely, at least initially, caused by linguistics of having to describe a situation. Dhamma is the barren, Swabhava is that which is born by the Dharma. Does this amount to the admission that there's a duality between these two? That which it is and that which it possesses. The bare and the born. A dichotomy which goes against the grain of the Buddhist doctrine of essencelessness. So if we say that a Dharma is that which bears its own nature, that makes it like have an essence, an Atman. Considering the context of the logical apparatus used by the Abhidharmakas in defining the Dharmas involves three main kinds of definition. So there's three possible ways of defining the situation of phenomena. Agency to the thing being defined, such as, for example, is the definition of cognition. It's that which cognizes. Second, instrumental to the thing to be defined. In the example of cognition, is that through which the mental factors cognize. So either the Dharma is that which cognizes, or the Dharma of cognition as that which through which we cognize. And the third is by nature, where the abstract nature of the thing to be defined is brought into focus. For example, the mere act of cognizing is cognition, a more abstraction level definition of defining of a dharma. The first two are said to be provisional and not valid from an ultimate point of view. So we have this introduction of the idea of provisional and definitive dharma or understanding. The attribution of agency and instrumentality invests the dharma with a duality when it is actually a unitary and unique phenomena. This attribution is called the assumption of a distinction where there is no distinction. It is like saying the body of Siliputta, as if Siliputta is distinct from his own body. We all say this, right? My body. It is this kind of assumption that leads to the wrong notion that a given dharma is a substance with inherent qualities or an agent which performs some kind of an action. Such definitions are based on tentative attribution and thus are not ultimately valid. It's a matter of convention and for the sole purpose of facilitating the grasp of the idea to be conveyed that a duality is assumed by the mind in defining the Dharma, which is actually devoid of such duality. Both agency and instrumentality definitions are resorted to for the convenience of description. As such, they're not to be understood in the literal sense. On the other hand, what is called definition by nature is the one that is admissible on the ultimate sense. This type of definition brings into focus the real nature of a given dharma without attributing agency or instrumentality to it, an attribution that creates the false notion of duality. Those two are attributions that create false. It is in this context of these implications that definition of dharma as that which bears its own nature has to be understood. This is a definition according to agency, and hence its validity is provisional. The idea that dharmas bears its own nature is provisional. It's an agency. From this definition, therefore, one cannot conclude that a given dharma is a substantial bearer of its qualities or own nature. The duality between the dharma and its qualities is only an attribution made for the convenience of definition. For in actual fact, both denote the same actuality. Hence, it's categorically stated that apart from Svabhava, there's no distinct entity called Dhamma, and that the term Svabhava signifies the mere fact of being a Dhamma. Elaborated on this, a commentary says that apart from the fact of being molested, here's the molested, which is the characteristic of matter, there is no separate entity called matter. And in the same way, apart from the fact of hardness, which is the characteristic of the earth element, there is no separate entity called the earth element. If Dhamma and Swabhava denote the same actuality, why is the Dhamma invested with the function of bearing its own nature? For this implies the recognition of an agency distinct from the Dhamma. Thus, it is observed, is done not only to conform the inclinations of those who would be destructive, but to stress the fact there's no agent behind the Dhamma. The point being emphasized that the dynamic world of sensory experience is not due to causes other than the self-same Dhammas into which it is finally reduced, in the interconnection of the Dhammas through causal relations that explains the variety and diversity of conditioned existence, and not some kind of trans-empirical reality which serves as their metaphysical ground, nor is it due to a creator. In other words, the definition of Dhamma is that which bears its Swabhava, means that any Dhamma represents a distinct fact of empirical existence not shared by others. Hence, Swabhava is also defined as that which is not held in common by others, as the nature peculiar to each Dharma, and as the own nature not predicable of other Dharmas. If the Dharmas are said to have own nature, this is only a tentative device to drive home the point. This commentarial definition poses an important problem. It goes against the earlier Theravada tradition, recorded in that text, that says that the five aggregates are devoid of own nature. Since the Dharmas are the basic factors of the five aggregates, this should mean that the Dhammas too are devoid of own nature. What is more, does not the very use of the term Swabhava, despite all its qualifications under which it's used, give the impression that a given Dhamma exists in its own right? And does this not amount to the admission that a Dhamma is some kind of quasi-substance? Anyway, I thought that was an interesting further drill into what is a Dhamma, which we haven't really, I feel, adequately explained. And I wonder if that was helpful in basically confusing us by creating a little more subtlety in what we think of as a Dhamma. Like, you know, when we look at the chart and we see all these name, all these words that are listed as Dhammas, and then we try to, like, in the matter, when we talk about matter and we go through this exercise of a particle having these seven or eight Dhammas.
What I really appreciated about what you just shared and elsewhere in the text is that the Abhidharma, feels so conceptual, and all these categories and lists. And what that reminds us is that this is actually a real invitation to get into the sensual world, that Dhammas are not abstract entities, but are alive and filled with qualities. If I could share another quote from this reading. This is on Sourcebook page 114, the source page 53. It is, in fact, not by resorting to the panyatis are the conceptual concepts, but by transcending them at the higher reaches of mind's unification, that one should be able to go beyond the conceptual and establish one's own mind directly on the real, Dhammas. This is what is called the transcendence of the conceptual level. In this connection, the meditator should first go beyond such concepts as earth element, water element, etc., and establish their mind directly on the individuating characteristics that correspond to them, such as solidity, viscidity, etc. It is when one is continuing to focus one's uninterrupted attention on them that the individuating characteristics become more and more evident, more and more clear, and one's whole material body appears in its true form as a mass of elementary material constituents, all empty and impersonal.
That was great. Thank you. So, yeah, this... I think there's a tendency, at least I had, I know for years in approaching Abhidharma, looking at these lists of trying to think of like this radical pluralism of all these different like elements flying around or something. and so I think that comes down to this sense of like, what is our view of our existence in this world? We unconsciously walk around with this sense of like, what happens when I reach out my arm? What happens when I speak? What happens when I open my eyes and see? And so on and so forth. And I thought it was very helpful to have those ways of viewing dharmas as much more sort of mystical, almost. What is other people's reactions to these?
What I've got from a lot of this is, when the mental touches the physical, you become more aware of those. And that's what kind of sends you on this path of, well, what is there? But ultimately, you know, getting past that duality, it's just your mind touching physical things, and the two come together, and what comes out of that, like consciousness and stuff. But if you can, like what you just read, Chris, I thought that really captured it. Like when you really touch something, you suddenly start to see more of what they're trying to get at. You know, it's hard to describe, but
I think it has something to do with the way our conceptual proliferation actually obscures the very world in front of us, and that by using the method of Abhidharma to deconstruct our conceptual overlays, the world is much more alive and vivid and rich with qualities. Mary Beth.
So a couple of things. I just sort of took the liberty of pulling out a book that we used in November of 2022 when we went through the physical world from the Dalai Lama series. And there's a really like 4 or 5 pages where they talk about the things about the 7 and the 8, and that one is sort of a subtle thing, and one is more an idea of the atom as an aggregate. I feel like that might be something helpful for us to all revisit to help us understand this better. And then, because I do not understand it too much, but something that jumps out at me is this idea that they're trying to break things down into like a single thing. And we're trying to kind of do away with the notion of duality. But it's almost like they're saying that they're the single things that we're trying to break it down into just don't hold up unless they're a part of like some kind of multiplicity of things rather than a duality. So like the duality, like me and everything else is doesn't work. But if I sort of think of just everything as so many just multiple multiples, and that's really the only way that it kind of holds together. And I'm talking about like the real, the not the real world. I'm talking about sort of the world that we live in, the conceptual world. It's not one, it's not made up of like groups of one and one and one and one, because no one could stand alone and no two could stand alone, but it really has to have like so many parts. So I don't know if that's helpful, but that's kind of where my head is about it.
Can you read any part of the description of the atoms? Is there some
Yeah, well,
paragraph or two?
there was one part about the sevens and the eights, and let me just see if I can, where they're talking about the so Vasubandhu speaks of two types of atom, the substantial atom, and he calls it Dravya Paramanu, and the aggregate atom or molecule Samgata Paramanu. And he says a substantial atom is indivisible, devoid of any parts, has no spatial dimension, as and is imperceptible. A single substantial atom can never exist on its own, but only in combination with other atoms. In contrast to a substantial atom, an aggregate atom is composed of at least eight substances. The atoms of the four elements, as well as those of color, smell, taste, and tangibility. Specific material aggregations have different balances of intensity among these. Thus, when, say, the color atom is predominant, we perceive color rather than some other derived matter, such as smell or taste.
Yeah, so that was the interpretation of the atoms that Chris presented early on.
Yeah.
So there would be separate atoms of earth, water, and so forth that would then come together as the conglomerates.
Yeah, it's a nice presentation of that, and I feel like it's a little just referring back to it quickly, I felt like it made the other things that we read a little easier to understand.
Yeah, so one of the complexities is like if every thing has these eight atoms, and everything is made up of these congregations of eight atoms. How do you come up with some things that are hard and some things that are water and some things that are fiery and so forth? And so the book you just read implied that they had more hardness, let's say, if they were something solid, right? So there's eight particles. How do you have more earth? Is the particle of earth bigger than the particle of water in the eight? Chris, do you have any sense of that? Anyone else?
Or there's Yeah, I think the eight is conceived of as the subtlest aggregate, but that aggregates could have many more parts than eight.
So there would
But
be
that all aggregates have at least these eight. These are sort of the minimum necessary.
And so one of each would be like the ideal, like the perfectly rounded or whatever, balanced particle. But in reality, most particles have either a predominance of one of the elements versus the others.
That's my understanding.
So are we saying then that that, call it differentiation, happens at that most basic, lowest level, as opposed to the next level up where they start to aggregate?
I think it would have to avoid the problem Derek's talking about of if all of the basic building blocks are this eight, there'd be no way to aggregate them in other ways. You know, if the only building block you get has these eight, aggregating them in one way versus another way is probably not going to yield different results.
So then essentially what we're saying is that this collection of eight qualities in this lowest level thing have different proportions of the eight. And that's what causes distinguishing qualities that would lead to the notion of solidity or cohesiveness or all those other elemental qualities and such?
Yeah, but there's more than just those eight. I think those eight are ingredients that are in anything perceptible, but then they kind of other dharmas can be in that mix too. So it's not as though there's only eight dharmas, you know, there's, depending on the system, you know, 100.
So wait, I'm sorry, I'm losing my mind here with, in terms of, well, never had one to get it, but I think I'm losing the terminology here. You're referring to dharmas, but is this basic level thing called a dharma, or are these atom things group into dharmas?
I think the atom things are dharmas.
The atom things are dharmas?
Yeah.
I think they're made up of dharmas. Because like if you look at the dharma chart, there's earth, water, fire, air.
Okay, so then see, this is what's driving me crazy. It's like is to try to pin where the dharma actually lives. Yes. You're saying it's at the level below the atom now. Okay.
That's what.
So Vasubandhu gave us two types of atoms, right? There's the
substantial and aggregate, or something was in
something like that. Yeah. So
that just read. I got that part. That part I could understand.
So I think the dharmas exist at the substantial level. That those are the dharmas, and then they aggregate, which then gives rise to the world we see.
And those substantial dharmas, are the things that have eight. Or more.
No, the eight is the simplest aggregation of the substantial dharmas.
So
the substantial dharma is a conglomeration of the basic particles, and the basic particles have eight substances or atoms in them.
Or is it at least eight? Wait, so these substantial and
aggregate. They do say atoms. At least. At least one of each. So as Chris is saying, it could be way more.
So that level, that thing that has the eight, is called a dharma as opposed to an atom? And where does atom live in this schema?
It says the aggregate atom is made up of at least eight substances.
Is atom and dharma the same?
The substantial atom is only one atom, but can never exist alone. It has to be with the other seven. It has to be in combination with other atoms.
I don't see a place where there's a correlation between atoms and dharmas in this chapter. Does anyone else?
No, not in the Dhammajoti chapter, which I was very frustrated by.
Yeah, it seems like we kind of need just simple layers of what is made of what, because it does seem like
I'll find some things and circulate. I'll circulate what Mary Beth is referring to.
Right, I can find that, I think. Although, what was the page number that you were on, Mary Beth? Or chapter, anyway.
It's called Part Three, Subtle Particles, and
Great.
it's like 6 or 7 pages in a row after
Yeah,
that.
thanks.
There's probably a lot more, but in the but.
Yeah, but I think it would just be helpful to try to establish the what is a part of what kind of, if we can, with the
Is
two of
it correct to say you can't have a single water like nugget or whatever you want to call it, that it has to be it, like can you have a single water?
That seems
Right,
to
you
be the
can't.
implication.
It has to be in congruence with the other base elements.
Yeah, the four great elements are said to always arise altogether.
Even though they're listed, like I'm looking at the 79 dharmas, they're listed each as a form of, as a causal form dharma, even still.
Yeah,
Can't
they're
be on
said
its own.
to cause each other and to always arise together.
Right. Okay.
But then this gets us back to this point of sort of a conceptual, like, so you can have like an individual water molecule, and that's the smallest version of the water molecule, but then it's conceptually separable into smaller things.
Well, and even a water molecule, like a little droplet of water, would also have the other elements in it. But it'd be
Right.
predominantly
And
water,
it's the
right.
conceptual severability of that rather than sort of the physical divisibility of it that distinguishes these dharmas as separate. But so anyway, congratulations, everyone. We made it through our unit on Abhidharma by the skin of our teeth, I think. I think that I was talking with Derek about like classes I would take in college where the professors would assign the really tough material on the for the, like the first week's homework or like during the dropout period. In order to weed out the slackers. So,
Next year.
it wasn't exactly our intention, but it kind of ended up that way that like, God, I mean, just like it's difficult and like totally frustrating material is really front loaded.
I gotta say, this is like, I like totally love this stuff. So I've enjoyed powering through it, even though it's dense. I think it's been great. It's nice to have this level of like really, really getting into all the schools and the weeds. I've found it really helpful to just go through it in great detail personally.
Well, you know, one of the really and why we felt like it was so important to include this material was that the debates that happen in the Abhidharma sort of aren't just contained to the Abhidharma, but like these questions about like what's causality and how do things exist and what's the relationship between parts and wholes, like those questions continue to play out for like thousands of years. Throughout the different schools. So there's sort of like constantly referring back to these problems that we've been wrestling with.
Yeah, absolutely. It's essential. And I don't know if this was sort of similar to what Mary Beth was saying earlier, that, as you try to break everything down into their individual parts, and then you figure out how the multiplicity works. And then as you keep going, you start to realize how the mind matter distinction doesn't make any sense. And, so it kind of pushes, all of these incomprehensible and hard to define things kind of push you to the another level of thinking about it and realizing, okay, no way that you describe it is going to work. And
It
therefore,
made me feel like that conclusion, like People tend to come to that conclusion so easily and quickly and dispense with the difficult project of like trying to describe things from a, you know, what Peter would call like a classical physics point of view, you know, like a classical Abhidharma. And like, we're so quickly to dismiss, you know, oh, this just doesn't make any sense. Everything's empty. And
right, but I'm not advocating for that quick dismissal, but you actually, you do wrestle with it enough to understand why you might have to try another tack, you know, at some point. But
is the other tact explaining it or dismissing it, Emily?
I don't know if this answers your question exactly, but I also think there's this extremely important experiential piece to this, where it's pretty easy, I think, especially for those of us who live in the modern era, to dismiss this stuff on a sort of theoretical or intellectual level. But as Chris said, like, we really are all probably still closet materialists. Like, even though sort of intellectually we can say, oh yeah, of course, like none of this really exists, we're all still like going about our day, I think, probably mostly from a materialistic standpoint. And I also think that's part of why we all keep trying to rationalize this from the point of view of modern physics. Like, I think we all really pretty much believe that's how the universe functions when we really, in our day to day. So I feel like it's like, yeah, it's, you can dismiss it pretty, this stuff pretty easily, but if you actually like look at it and read it and really try to like there was a part where it said, like, the whole point of this is to understand experiences that arise in meditation and also as a guide for what to take into meditation practice. And I feel like that's so important to keep remembering. It's like the whole point of this is to allow us to experientially break down our sense of self. And that's a whole different project. And it makes sense to me why there are so many complicated systems for trying to get people to actually live their lives this way, even a little bit. Yeah. Derek, you're muted if you're trying to talk.
Sorry, there's this nice sense summing things up in the text later on that I thought was worth sharing. This shows the relevance of the Dhamma theory to Buddhist mental culture. As mentioned at the beginning of the chapter, the Dhamma theory was intended from the start to be more than hypothetical. Its purpose is to serve as guide for meditative contemplation and insight, as opposed to mere sophistry. The next page is Dhamma as ultimately real. Anyway, fascinating topic if you allow yourself to actually wrestle with the project, the so-called Abhidharma project. So thank you all for persevering through this difficult first section, and now we transition to the Madhyamaka, which we're all way more familiar with and comfortable with. I think that's where we go next. Is that right?
I think so. Yeah. So we're going to start with some of the sutras. So we're looking at one of
source the, material.
Yeah, the primary sources. We're looking at the Prajnaparamita Sutra in 8,000 lines. And then we've also included this really beautiful praise to Prajnaparamita, which was it's not a sutra source, but it was supposedly traditionally included as like the frontispiece of the printings of the 8,000 verse Prajnaparamita, and it's allegedly by Nagarjuna's teacher. I really thought of it as a peace offering to this group after the Abhidharma material. So I hope that everyone enjoys it. I find it really beautiful. And then we're also going to read two chapters from the Vimalakirti Sutra, which for those of you who know it is just know that it's just like great fun. So I think we'll have sort of a lighter class next time. Yeah.
Thank you, Chris. Thank you, everyone. By this merit, may all attainted nations may defeat the enemy wrongdoing from the stormy waves of birth, old age, sickness, and death, from the ocean of samsara, may have free all beings by the confidence of the golden sun of the great east. May the lotus garden of the Rigdon's wisdom bloom. May the dark ignorance of sentient beings be dispelled. May all beings enjoy profound, brilliant glory.
Thank you.
Thank you again. Yeah, take care, everyone. See you soon. Good night.